My topic for this morning is gold standards, true and false. And this topic is particularly apropos because next year is the 60th anniversary of the Bretton Woods system, which was a false gold standard. And the collapse gave the gold standard yet another black eye. As I said, it ignominiously collapsed in 1971 when President Nixon closed the gold window, so to speak. And so this is pretty funny, so let me let you listen to what he says here.
The third indispensable element in building the new prosperity is closely related to creating new jobs and halting inflation.
No.
We must protect the position of the American dollar as a pillar of monetary stability around the world. In the past 7 years, there's been an average of one international monetary crisis every year. Now, who gains from these crises? Not the working man, not the investor, not the real producers of wealth. The gainers are the international money speculators. Because they thrive on crises, they help to create them. In recent weeks, the speculators have been waging an all-out war on the American dollar. The strength of a nation's currency is based on the strength of that nation's economy. And the American economy is by far the strongest in the world. Accordingly, I have directed the Secretary of the Treasury to take the action necessary to defend the dollar against the speculators. I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and in the best interest of the United States. Now, what does this action, which is very technical, what does it mean for you? Let me lay to rest the bugaboo of what is called devaluation. If you want to buy a foreign car or take a trip abroad, market conditions may cause your dollar to buy slightly less. But if you are among the overwhelming majority of Americans who buy American-made products in America, your dollar will be worth just as much tomorrow as it is today. The effect of action, in other words, will be to stabilize the dollar.
I can't take this anymore. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so that was the last gasp of the Bretton Woods system. It actually started to die in 1968. In that video clip, Nixon claims that it was because of speculators. It had nothing to do with the tremendous inflation that occurred during the 1960s, which, as we'll see, was undertaken to pay for the war, that is the Vietnam War, at the same time that you didn't have to raise taxes for consumers. So President Johnson promised guns and butter. In other words, military equipment and consumer goods. So it was a way to get around overtly showing the American people how much the Vietnam War really cost. Without that inflation, the Vietnam War would have come to an end much more quickly. That is, if people saw the actual money costs reflected in their tax bills. So he says three things there. One, it's the speculators. Okay, the speculators are simply speculating on what he just did, that the inflation of dollars was going to cause eventually a fall in the value of the dollar, so that at some point the U.S. government could no longer pay out gold, because that's what it promised to do under the Bretton Woods system, and would have to renege on its solemn pledge to all the other nations in the International Monetary Fund to continue to convert their dollar liabilities of their central banks and their governments into gold at the rate of $35 per ounce. So speculators were right. Okay, they were just they saw the inflation and they realized that the dollar would have to devalue. And he claims again that, well, you know, if you're the kind of American that wants to buy foreign imports or take trips to Europe, you might have to pay a little bit more. Okay, but if you're the good old-fashioned American who buys everything in America, you're not going to have to pay anymore. Well, let's look at that claim. There is 1971 when he closed the gold window. There's the price level rising more than, let's see, 71's about at 40. An index number of 40. It rises to 240 by 2012 or so. So that's six times. Okay, so it rose 500%. Okay. Now, what was interesting was that they entered into a new agreement without gold. It was called the Smithsonian Agreement. It was held in Washington, and it was a regime of fixed exchange rates. And I'll get into all this in a moment, but I just want to tell you the story. And at the time, Nixon, just as buffoonishly as he did there, called the Smithsonian Agreement the greatest monetary agreement in the history of the world. And 13 months later, it again collapsed, and we got floating exchange rates. But let me sort of start this off by showing you the spectrum of international monetary systems, beginning with the best on the left side. Okay, so the 100% gold standard, really, that's how money came into being as commodities. And the general medium of exchange eventually throughout the world was gold and silver. Silver was generally used for smaller exchanges and gold for international exchanges and larger purchases. Gold was primarily used in the 19th century, in the later 19th century in Western Europe. Silver continued to be used in India and China and so on. We don't have much historical data on the 100% gold standards because governments pretty much started to interfere almost immediately with monetary systems. So the experience we have with a true commodity money is a classical gold standard, which had some flaws in it, and we'll go through the classical gold standard. Okay, and the classical gold, the biggest flaw is that it did permit a central bank to exist. Right? And then we move to a different kind of money altogether. Now, if you've taken international economics, when you get to the section on international monetary economics, they say there are two types of monetary systems. One is called fixed exchange rates. And what's interesting is they put the gold standard, which had fixed exchange rates, they group it along with fixed exchange rates based on monopoly currency. So for example, the classical gold standard would be grouped with a world money that was or a monies based on world reserves created by a world central bank. Okay, but that's really, in terms of the essential economics of the whole system, totally different. Okay, here, it's really the market controls the supply of money. Even under the classical gold standard, the central banks, to the extent that they exist, have their hands tied by the amount of gold that is in the economy and that is produced every year through mining. But here, this is all based on monopoly fiat money. Each different government has its own national money, and it can inflate it at different rates. So the Bretton Woods system is here. It's a pseudo gold standard, a version of it's called the gold exchange standard. A version of the standard existed from 1925 to 1931 in Europe, and then the Bretton Woods system itself existed from 1946 to 1971. Interestingly enough, there was a bill that was introduced, which I'll talk about, earlier this year by Representative Ted Poe to bring back, I think it's called the Dollar Bill Act of 2013, to bring back this pseudo-gold standard. Okay, and that is one of the worst things that could happen because that would just simply put the last nail in the coffin of the gold standard. Right now, there's a lot of genuine interest in bringing gold back, even among a few international bureaucratic functionaries, people in China, the government of China, Brazil has talked about it. So if we go back to a gold standard, we want to go back to a genuine gold standard, one that really does restrain inflation, that does tie the hands of inflation-inclined governments. So Austrians are in favor of the 100% gold standards. monetarists claim that such a gold standard, that a gold standard is simply a price-fixing arrangement, that the government fixes the price of gold in terms of the dollar, that dollar is the real money, but that to restrain the supply of dollars, they put in this rule where you have to fix the price of dollars in terms of gold. Okay, and that's actually true of Bretton Woods. The Bretton Woods system did do that. Okay, and the supply-siders, the ones that are remaining from the 1980s Reagan Revolution, so-called, they are the ones that are still pushing to bring back some form, even today, of the gold standard. For example, Steve Forbes supports this bill by Ted Poe to bring back this kind of watered-down, phony gold standard. Okay? Keynesians don't want any part of the gold standard, never really did. They would rather have, their dream really is a world central bank that could create paper reserves and give them to countries that were running deficits. Okay. So let me just say a few words about the gold standard. First of all, if we're going to go look at the classical gold standard, which I think we will do because we do have information, historical information about the classical gold standard, it existed okay, just to give you an example. In the U.S., it existed from 1834 to 1933. Actually, 1914 is... After 1914, even the classical gold standard was watered down, but it was still based on gold. And in England, from 1821 to 1931. And the first characteristic of the classical gold standard is to set a definition of the unit, whether it's the dollar or the pound, in terms of a weight of gold. So the U.S. dollar for that 100-year period was defined as 23.22 grains of gold, which is approximately equal to 1/20 of an ounce of gold. And that meant that anyone could take a $20 bill, go into a branch of the Treasury, or go into a bank that had dealings with the Treasury, and in exchange for the $20, get a full ounce of gold. In Great Britain, £1 was defined as 113 grains of gold, five times the amount of gold as in a dollar, and therefore it was equal to about 1/4 of an ounce of gold. Okay, so therefore, you had what we called exchange rates, but they weren't really exchange rates. Okay. From 1834 onward, the exchange rate was $4.86 per pound. Now, the mantras like to call this a price-fixing agreement, that they're fixing the price of gold. No. Gold is defined not as pieces of paper. It's defined as a weight unit. Okay? The franc was about 1/100 of a pound, of an ounce of gold. And then they exchanged according to their different weights. So this wasn't even a real exchange rate. That's not an exchange rate. That simply says, that's just a law of arithmetic. There's five times the amount of gold in a pound as there is in a dollar. Therefore, it takes $5 to equal the same amount of gold that is contained in a pound. It's like saying that the exchange rate between nickels and quarters is 5 to 1. 5 nickels for 1 quarter. And somebody has to keep it stable or something. No, that's ridiculous. A nickel is defined as 1/20 of a dollar. A quarter is defined as 1/4 of a dollar. 5 times 1/20 equals 1/4. Okay? It's just an arithmetical relationship. So what the monetarists do not understand, and there are not many monetarists around anymore, let's say the New Keynesians and the monetarists. The New Keynesians are really successors of the monetarists in some sense. What they don't understand is that the dollar is not the money. The dollar was simply a name of weight of gold. And the paper dollar was, under the classical gold standard, a claim, a title, to be able to redeem into the amount of gold in the denomination of that title. So, to give you an example, a visual, that's the front and back, or the obverse and reverse, of the $50 bill. Notice it says the United States of America, $50 in gold coin, okay? This is just a ticket, like your dry cleaning ticket that you get to pick up your money at, you know, that is being held by the central bank, okay? In the U.S., we didn't have a central bank until 1914. And I don't know when this was. Let's see the date on here if I can find it for you. Anyway, it says, United States of America, $50 in gold coin, payable to the bearer on demand. It means it's a ticket. Okay? That's what that small print is there. Here's something interesting. Here's a ticket for $100,000 worth of gold, 1934. That was not circulated. That was traded between banks. That was a way of settling accounts between banks. It never really got into circulation. I think it was only printed in 1 year. But again, that was a ticket to gold. That wasn't money itself. Okay? That was what Mises would call a money substitute. If it was fully backed up by gold, it would be called a money certificate. If it was only partially backed by gold, it would be called a fiduciary media. Okay, so it doesn't involve fixed exchange rates. Also, what under the so next thing we want to do is discuss what caused the gold standard to be so effective a barrier against inflation. And here we have something called the price specie flow mechanism, fancy name, but I'll explain it first and then I'll put the name up. Okay, here's what the gold standard looked like. Let's say there's a central bank. And let's say the central bank held $2 billion in gold, okay? Because eventually, even under the classical gold standard, central banks were able to centralize everyone's holdings of gold, or at least all banks' holdings of gold, in the vaults of the central bank, okay? And let's assume that by law, the central bank had to hold 40% reserves. So that means that they could create $5 billion of their notes. Just look at ignore for the moment what the red figures, okay? Because $2 billion of gold is 40% in reserves in relation to $5 billion. And then those central bank notes were got into circulation and people put them in the banks and they got into the banks, the commercial banks, the banks that you and I use, they got into the bank as their reserves, okay? Because people wanted checking accounts. And or they might even want the notes of those commercial banks. Commercial banks could print notes up until about 1920s, okay? But after the 1890 or so, they were heavily taxed. Okay. So banks basically eventually began to offer only checking account money. So now if they have to hold 20%, they're not holding gold anymore, okay? Now what they're doing is they're holding the central bank notes. Okay, so let's say they now have $5 billion worth of central bank notes, and they can then, through the money multiplier process, loan money out, and given that the exchange rate is 20%, we talked about this in my class on banking, that means that five times the amount of checking deposit money can be created. Okay, so you have $25 billion there. Okay. And so all of those dollars, all of those $25 billion are claims on the $2 billion here sitting in the central bank. The extent that people trusted the banking system, there wouldn't be a problem. But the problem would arise almost immediately when the central bank began to increase its own notes, which it always had an inclination to do. Okay, so let me just get some water here. So if we may assume or suppose the example I've given here, let's say the central bank legally reduces its reserves to 33%, okay? Which means that it can create, on the top of the $2 billion of reserves, it can create an additional $1 billion in gold, in central bank notes, excuse me. So now it expands the amount of reserves in the economy. Notice what happens. As that money's paid out, it gets back into the commercial banks as reserves, increases their reserves by $1 billion, and they increased the money supply by 20%, from $25 to $30 billion. That's a huge increase. When that money is spent, it increases prices in the economy. Okay? As prices in the economy increase, Americans, okay, who are holding this greater amount of money, begin to buy more foreign goods because foreign goods are now relatively cheaper, and foreigners begin to buy fewer American products. So here's where the price-specie flow mechanism comes in. I mean, can the central bank keep doing that? No. In fact, it might have to reverse or deflate the money supply that it had already expanded. And if you just look at the top series of symbols, when the money supply in the U.S., okay, is increased, okay, U.S. prices rise above the prices of world prices. So P sub U.S., subscript U.S., prices in the U.S., P sub W is the world price level. Okay, there's an equilibrium there. Gold is distributed throughout the world, throughout the trading world, so that all prices or the purchasing power of money is about equal everywhere. But suddenly now, if prices suddenly jump above that in the U.S., you're going to get U.S. exports falling, U.S. imports increasing. Foreigners are going to buy less in your market because in terms of gold, your prices are higher now. And you're going to buy more imports from abroad. So as the U.S. imports go up, U.S. exports fall, we get the balance of payments deficit. It's less than zero, which means that it's negative, which means that there is a deficit. So do foreigners want our paper dollars? They don't use paper dollars in their own economies. Okay? They use pounds or francs or gold. So to finance that deficit, the U.S. has to send gold. So the importers that are purchasing are going to find that they're going to have to go to the banks and demand gold. The banks, in turn, will take their central bank notes and send them to the central bank in exchange for gold. The central bank will begin to lose some of its gold. Okay, so the U.S. gold stock will fall. Okay, as that happens, though, they'll have to decrease the amount of notes that they've printed and put into circulation. And those notes are the reserves of the commercial banks. So the whole system contracts again. So there's a temporary inflation. There is some business cycle implications that you might have a business cycle or you may not, or may not be very, very deep. But in any case, what does happen is eventually that you'd have to at least stop inflating, if not contract the money supply, actually deflate the money supply, so that eventually your prices now fall below the world price, gold flows back in, you export more than you import, and you get a surplus in your balance of payments. So your gold stock is restored. So that the gold standard was known as the golden handcuff because of what's called price specie. Specie refers to any sort of precious metal, silver or gold, okay? Flow mechanism, okay? If one country inflated more than the other countries, they would eventually lose gold or silver. Okay? And when that happened, the backing for their currency would fall, the reserves would fall. And the threat was an internal drain. As gold flowed out of the country, okay, that's an external drain, people would begin to fear that their banks would not be able to pay out or convert their dollars into gold. And once that happened, they would rush to the banks and you would get the internal drain, which is worse than the external drain. Okay? People would pull their money out. So central banks are very careful about monetary policy. They couldn't inflate very much. So inflation is kept under control. And the third point I wanted to make, therefore, the money supply under the classical gold standard was strictly limited by the market, okay? By the supply and demand forces in the market for gold. Remember, gold was not just desired as money, but also for many other uses, including jewelry dentistry and so on, okay? So there was a thriving gold market. The stock of gold did not increase much by much from year to year. So the money supply was pretty stable. Okay? The only way the money supply could change radically would be if the central bank increased or decreased its notes that were based on the gold standard or based on its gold reserves. So the result, if I may show you that, is that as a capitalist economy grows, okay, as the amount of goods and services increases, we've seen, for example, in high-tech industries today, in plastic surgery and so on, prices come down. Okay, well, in today's world, we know that the price of computers have fallen tremendously. You could get a mainframe computer in 1970 for $3 million. Today, you can get a laptop that is five or six times as fast, has much more memory than a whole mainframe that would take up this whole or half of this room. Okay, you can get that for $500 to $1,000. Okay, so but that the growth in the high tech industries, or cell phones also, and other types of items, it's so rapid that it out. It's much more rapid than the increase in the amount of money that the U.S. government is printing. So even though the government is continually expanding the money supply, some industries, because of their growth, can keep ahead of that, and they'll actually have falling prices. Under a gold standard, all prices in the economy would fall because all goods would expand. The supplies of all different goods would increase over time as the economy developed through saving and investment and technological improvement, and you would get supply curve shifting to the right. The demand curves wouldn't shift too much to the right because there would be no new money in the economy or very little new money, and so prices would come down. So to give you an example, prices actually fell by about 20% from 1800 in the U.S. to 1914. In other words, it only took you 80 cents to buy in 1914 what you could have purchased, what it would have taken you, a dollar to buy in 1800. Okay? Prices had fallen. In fact, if you just take it to the year 1896, before there were new gold discoveries in South Africa, prices had actually fallen by 33%. Okay? Then with new gold discoveries, you had an increase, and prices began to rise again. So that, for example, by 1914, there was an inflation from 1896 to 1914, but very interestingly, it was about 1% per year. Okay, if you can see this. It was about 1% per year, and people called it the Great Inflation. They weren't used to prices going up every year. They're used to prices falling. Okay, so it's about 18 years. In 18 years, prices went up by about 19% because of the increase in the supply of gold. And also, you have to keep in mind there was probably increases in paper money during that period. It wasn't all due to gold. So if you take it to 1914, prices had risen by about 19%. But not compared to, as I said, overall, they were still below what they were in 1800, even after that gold inflation. So you would tend to have a continually falling, gently falling, price level in the economy under the gold standard. Now, what happened to the gold standard? Well, it got blamed. It was a case of misidentification. It was blamed for the collapse or the crash of the stock market in 1929, and then the Great Depression that followed. And so, the day after he took office, in 1933, this was issued on April 5th. I think he took office on April 4th, 1933. President Roosevelt issued Executive Order 6102. All persons are required to deliver on or before May 1st, 1933, all gold coin, gold bullion, and gold certificates now owned by them to a Federal Reserve Bank branch or agency, or to any member bank of the Federal Reserve System. And that fine print is all the terrible things that would happen to you if you didn't do that. Criminal penalties for violation, actually it's at the bottom. So it says criminal penalties for violation of executive order, $10,000 fine, or 10 years imprisonment, or both, as provided in Section 9 of the order. Okay, so it is somewhere in that order. Okay. They make sure they wanted you to know that. And the postmaster was supposed to post this in every post office. Okay. So we went off the gold standard. Not only did we go off the gold standard, but American citizens were no longer permitted to own gold and didn't get that right back until 1976. Well, they always had the right. But they didn't get the permission of the government back until 1976. The only people that could own gold were licensed dentists and jewelers and others that worked with gold. It was even illegal to own gold in a foreign country, so you couldn't have a gold account in Canada, for example. So many things happened. I'll answer the point of information. Yeah, I think collectibles, antiques were allowed, okay? But, you know, I don't know much about that, but the antiques certainly were allowed, yeah. So between 1933 and 1946, we had horrible chaos in the monetary system. We had competing devaluations. For example, the U.S. devalued. They lowered the value of gold from $35. I'm sorry, they lowered the value of the dollar by raising the price of gold from $35 to $38. And every morning, the story goes, the Secretary of the Treasury would come into President Roosevelt's bedroom. He'd still be in his pajamas, and they pick a number. They change a gold price. What they were trying to do was to get gold to flow into the U.S. Okay, they were trying to devalue the dollar, make it worth less. Okay, by in effect, if you raise the price of gold, what you're doing is it means that you have to go and print more money to buy gold and drive its price up in terms of your money. So more of your money gets into circulation. That's what devaluation means. Basically means inflation, okay? It just, as Mises puts it, devaluation is just another technique for inflation. So we had competing devaluations. So if we tried to devalue so that our money was worth less, and therefore we were able to export more to other countries with the purpose of increasing employment during the Great Depression in our country, other countries wouldn't just stand by. They would devalue their money. So it was competing devaluations. The whole system was wacky. And business decision makers, businessmen, basically stopped investing. Okay, there were different exchange controls. Okay, so they added to the devaluation the amount of money that could flow out of a country into another country. So as World War II was winding down, the Allies decided we don't want to go back this chaotic monetary system that we had between 1933 and 1946, World War II. So they got together and tried to come up with a plan to restore at least the prestige of the gold standard without actually restoring the gold standard. And they got together at Bretton Woods, and the 60th anniversary of this meeting is next year. And this is a beautiful resort in New Hampshire. In fact, I was there at the Libertarian Conference Pork Fest, which was held about 12 miles from this place this summer, just a few weeks ago, actually, about a month ago, I guess. And it's been restored, but the structure itself hasn't been touched. It's been the interior has been restored. It's beautiful. Mount Washington overlooks it. It's just a beautiful place. So. Delegates from all different countries, including the Soviet Union, anyone but basically the Axis powers were invited, okay? And, of course, the two biggest players were the United States and Great Britain. And these two men each came up with plans, different plans. John Maynard Keynes, Harry Dexter White, Soviet spy. A book just came out this year about Harry Dexter White. Let me see if I can find a little passage from it. Okay, he was a Soviet spy. Let me see if... But he did it for good reasons. You know, he did it for... You know, he was genuine and... Okay, so he was an American economist and a senior U.S. Treasury Department official. He was a senior American official at the 1944 Bretton Woods Conference, and reportedly dominated the conference and imposed his vision of post-war financial institutions over the objections of Keynes, which is difficult to do. Keynes was a great polemicist, great at pushing his view, great at changing people's minds. But White overcame that. After the war, White was a major architect of the International Monetary Fund, which is still with us, and the World Bank. In August 1948, White testified and defended his record to the House Un-American Activities Committee. 3 days after he testified, he died of a heart attack. Now, historians agree he passed secret information. Everyone agrees he passed secret information to the Soviet Union during World War II. The author of the new book, Ben Stile, says White acted out of idealism, not as a member of the Communist Party, because, quote, not simply because he believed that the Soviet Union was a vital U.S. ally, so he was doing it for the U.S., but because he also believed passionately in the success of the bold Soviet experiment with socialism. Now, socialism is always an experiment, okay? So in case a lot of people get killed, which I always do, well, we were experimenting, you know, you can't know for sure what's going to happen, you know, so you always hear that. It's an experiment. And Keynes talked about communism in the same way. He didn't like communism because it was a working class movement. He was an aristocrat. He said if it came down to it, he'd be on the side of the barracks with his own class. He said that. He said, but he says, I applaud the Soviets and I applaud Mussolini and Hitler for their new bold experiments. This is in the early 30s, he said that. They all love the experiments, right? They want to experiment with human beings is what they want to do. Okay. It goes on to say that Stile says White was not a Communist Party member, and that may very well be true, because White would not take orders from Moscow. He worked on his own terms. Yeah, he worked as a commie giving, you know, he wanted to give the stuff to them. He joined no underground movements. Okay, he was a commie spy in any case. All right, everyone agrees, okay? I mean, you don't have to be McCarthyite to say that Harry Dexter White was a spy. Okay. Now, that's not the real problem, though, because the whole system was messed up. I mean, that's the problem. Let me explain how it worked. It's very the Bretton Woods system that developed, that was put into place in 1946. There was to be one key currency, okay? That would be the only currency that was convertible into gold. And, of course, that key currency was the currency of the most powerful country in the world at the time. The only really superpower standing, that was the U.S. So the U.S. dollar would be convertible into gold at the rate of $35 per ounce. So there was a huge devaluation from $20 per ounce under the old classical gold standard to $35 per ounce because of all the inflation that had occurred during World War II. Now, all the other currencies would be tied to the dollar at a fixed rate of exchange. So the pound, I think, was initially fixed at $2.80 or so per dollar, $2.80 per pound. Okay, so there was a whole system of fixed exchange rates. Those currencies were not convertible directly into gold. They were convertible into dollars. This was called the gold exchange standard. You could either hold gold to back up your currency, or you could hold foreign exchange. So they held U.S. dollars, actually U.S. dollars that they then invested in U.S. government securities. Now, you and I, your parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents, could not convert their dollars into gold, as you could under the classical gold standard. There was no circulation of gold coin or bullion, the bars, in the United States. The only groups that could convert currency dollars into gold were foreign central banks and foreign governments, foreign official institutions, basically. Right? So there was no gold in circulation. So this is why it was really a phony gold standard. Now, what was interesting here was that this caused a more unstable monetary system. Because now you had the U.S. gold, and I'll give you figures on this in a moment. The U.S. gold stock was at the bottom, right? And pyramided on top of the gold was the Fed notes and deposits, which then served as reserves for the U.S. commercial bank deposits. And what about foreign currencies? What the foreign currencies did, and the foreign banks, they used dollars as their reserves. So now, given that the foreign central banks did have a claim on the U.S. gold stock, the U.S. gold stock was supporting the whole superstructure of world currencies. Okay, and that became, initially that was fine because the U.S. had so much of the gold stock. And let me just give you an idea. Okay, so at the end of the war, we had, I think, more than half of the world's gold, maybe even more than that, $25 billion in gold we held. Okay. Because the European countries were buying a lot of military equipment from the U.S., and so gold was flowing into the U.S. There were only $12 billion of foreign liabilities, that is, foreign central banks and governments and so on, held $12 billion. So there was more than 100% gold backing. So no one was worried that the U.S. couldn't pay its dollar liabilities because U.S. citizens had no claim on that gold. So therefore, it was all available to be redeemed, to redeem the foreign currencies with, okay, or the foreign holdings of dollars, excuse me. Over time, the European countries stopped inflating, okay, and by 1958, they stabilized their currencies. The U.S. continued to inflate more. It began to lose some gold. Okay, then the Vietnam War started. Also, the Great Society programs that came in with President Lyndon Johnson. As I said, President Lyndon Johnson wanted to finance both the war and these welfare programs and Medicare without raising taxes. And the only way to do that, of course, was to increase the money supply, which was done. And as the money supply went up, we had that price specie flow mechanism operating. U.S. prices went above European prices. And we had continuing balance of payments deficits from 1958 onward. Okay, and so what happened? Initially, so we had more and more dollars piling up abroad, $50 billion by 1967. The U.S. put a lot of pressure on foreign central banks not to redeem their dollars in gold. France and Germany in around 1967 wanted to redeem their dollars in gold because they saw that the U.S. Gold stock was diminishing and foreign liabilities in dollars were increasing, and they clamored for gold redemption. West Germany was still an occupied country, so the U.S. made a veiled threat to West Germany that, you know, if you really push for redeeming the mark, your dollars into gold, we're going to remove the nuclear umbrella from the from Germany. Okay, we're paying a lot to protect you from the Soviets, you know, and to occupy your country with all American tanks and bases all over the place. I mean, but they backed off. The French under Charles de Gaulle didn't back off. His economic advisor was an economist that admired Mises a lot and who was a Misesian monetary theory, pro-gold standard, advised de Gaulle to get the gold back, that the U.S. will never be able to pay it off in the future. De Gaulle listened. The French eventually sent a warship. Okay, they sent a warship to New York to get their gold back from the New York Fed. Okay, you know, they didn't send any civilian ship, you know, just in case there's any problems, any loose icebergs that they may have encountered going back across the North Atlantic or anything else that would cause the ship to sink, you know, and any problems. The CIA was still operating then, so they did the right thing. They got their gold back, and they dropped out of NATO. They dropped out of NATO for a while, and they built up their own nuclear force because they didn't want to be susceptible, vulnerable to U.S. threats of removing the nuclear umbrella. 1968, things got even worse, as you see there. At that point, what was happening was there were free gold markets. European citizens could own gold. So in Zurich and in London, there were free gold markets. So you could buy and sell dollars and gold. You could sell your dollars and buy gold. The prices were going up above $35. They were going up to $40 or, you know, $42. The only way the U.S. could keep those prices down, which was an embarrassment, the fact that the dollar was starting to lose value in terms of gold on the private markets would be to, they were sending more gold over. They were buying up the dollars with the gold. And so our gold stock continued to fall. By 1971, this is when Nixon gave that buffoonish announcement. By then, there was a run on gold in those free markets. Okay. In 1968, by the way, all the central banks agreed that they would not exchange gold at any price but $35 an ounce. Okay, the U.S. put pressure on them to do that, even though gold was worth more in the private markets, so that they wouldn't pay attention to the private market price. So, but anyway, there was a run on the gold. On gold, prices were going up. The U.S. was said that they, within 2 weeks we would have lost our whole gold stock if we kept trying to push the price down in those private markets. And that's when Nixon closed the gold window, and just happened also to impose wage and price controls, which is another fascist measure. Okay. But let's look at the mechanics of all this. The Bretton Woods system was set up to fail. Okay. Because, as Jacques Rueff, as I mentioned before, the advisor to De Gaulle pointed out, the U.S. could run a deficit without tears. Okay. And what he meant by that was, whenever the U.S. inflated and drove its prices up, what would happen would be that the dollars would flow out, there would be a balance of payments deficit, our exports would go down because they were so expensive, and imports would go up because Americans were shifting to foreign goods and services, which were cheaper. When those dollars went to the countries didn't demand gold. They were holding those dollars, at first because they trusted the U.S., and then later on because the U.S. was putting pressure on them to hold those dollars. Now, if you know that that running deficits and printing money, okay, running your own budget deficits, the U.S. was running a budget deficit and then financing it with printing money, if you know that there's no consequence to that, you're going to continue to print the money. You are the key currency. You're the only one who can pay out gold, and the others aren't asking for the gold, or you're stopping them from getting the gold. So what De Gaulle pointed out was that the incentive was for the U.S. to continue to run deficits year after year. It was an easy way to pay for their welfare programs. It was an easy way to pay for the war. And so there was no reason to stop it, okay, unless the other countries demand their gold back. So what that meant was that what would happen was that there was a huge gold overhang, it was called, a dollar overhang, $80 billion out there. All were demands on gold. And Rueff predicted in the 60s, the early 60s, that this system will fail. Not only Rueff, but Henry Hazlitt, the American economist, predicted for the same reason, because of the misaligned incentives. The incentives was for the U.S. to continually just pile up deficits and print money to finance them. So Hazlitt also pointed this out. Another economist who was a Polish economist and then went to France, Michael Heilperin, and then finally settled in the U.S. and was a writer for Fortune and a friend of Mises, worked with Mises in Switzerland. He also pointed out there were three or four economists who predicted that the Bretton Woods system would collapse. This is when all the mainstream economists were saying, we just need to tweak it a little bit more. The only thing we really need to do is, the U.S. isn't printing enough money. We don't have enough liquidity. What we should do is have the IMF print SDRs, which we'll call special drawing rights. They're still on the books today. And they call that paper gold. So we would allow the deficit countries to pay off their deficits with SDR. So in other words, give the U.S. paper and let them pay off their deficits with these SDRs that were issued by some kind of a quasi-world central bank. Okay. So it was doomed to failure. Okay. And the other thing was, if you're sending paper to Europe and they're sending you all these goods, guess who's paying for the Vietnam War? The Europeans. You're sending them paper year after year that they're not redeeming for gold. And what are they sending you in exchange? They're sending you tourist services so your citizens can continue to enjoy tourism. They're sending you French wine. They're sending you perfume. They're sending items from Great Britain and so on and so forth. And they're getting paper in return. So we exported inflation. And by the way, we caused inflation. So we exported inflation, meaning that as the dollars came in to their exporters, those exporters would go to their central banks and say, we want our we want francs for these dollars. We want marks for these dollars. We want pounds. And so their central banks would then have to buy up those dollars. So we started an inflation and then caused it to be a worldwide inflation. Okay? And at the same time, there's a term that the economists use, seigniorage. That is, the group or the central bank that prints money is the group that enjoys or that receives that money from the central bank first. That's the group that enjoys the benefits of inflation, right? Prices haven't gone up yet, and yet people are spending these dollars on foreign goods. By the time the Europeans get the dollars, prices have already risen. So in effect, we're getting real goods and services from them. We're giving them paper. And so that's why the whole thing broke down. Okay. And as I said, Nixon, they then came up with an agreement to have fixed exchange rates because they didn't want to go back to the 1930s where you had competing inflations and devaluations. And as a result of that, that system didn't work. It lasted, you know, the U.S. continued to inflate. So our currency became overvalued. That is, it wasn't really worth what the exchange rate was indicating. And eventually it broke down in 13 months. Okay. And then we went to what we have today. Okay, so what we have today is floating exchange rates. So just to look at what has happened, go back to 1914. Now let's look at the period where the gold standard was either watered down, wasn't real, or we had pure floating exchange rates. Actually, I have a more up-to-date. At least I think I do. Yeah. Yes. More up to date, like 2012. So it now takes, it took you in 2012, $22.57 to purchase what you could have bought for $1 in 1914. Prices have risen by more than 22 times. That is, your dollar's worth a nickel in terms of what it was worth in 1914. Okay? It would take you $7.23 in the year 2012 to buy what a dollar could buy in 1933. Now, let's compare it to the year when Nixon went off, closed the gold window on the foreign powers. The price level has gone up about six times. So today, you would need $5.67 to buy what you could have bought for a dollar in 1971. So even though you had a watered-down, phony gold standard that the U.S. controlled, just that link to gold still had a bit of bite to it to prevent inflation, to prevent the U.S. from inflating faster. And now that that's all gone, of course, we don't, there's no longer any control or mechanism to restrict inflation in any part of the world. The only thing that we have left is the fact that, well, if the U.S. inflates too much, the value of our dollar is going to fall rapidly, and the Chinese and others who are holding a lot of dollars will offload these dollars, will get rid of them. They'll stop buying government bonds, and our interest rates will shoot up. Okay, so the Keynesians would like to go to one world money. If you go to one world money, then there's no escape. Then there's no control whatsoever. The last thing I want to do is quickly mention that, as I said, there is this new plan out there to go back to the Bretton Woods system. It's even actually worse than the Bretton Woods system. Basically, it says that what they want the government to do is set a target date, and then within 90 days of that target date, and no later than or at least 90 to between 90 and 120 days from that target date, to set a price of gold on the commodities markets here in the U.S., and then print money if it falls below that price, and if gold rises above that price, that means we're too inflationary to take money out of the system. Okay, it's still going to leave. There's not going to be any gold coins in circulation. You and I aren't going to be able to convert our dollars into gold coins. There's not going to be any real conversion, even with foreign governments. The Fed's still going to be in existence. They want the way that they're going to control the price of gold is through open market operations, which they do today. So basically, it's a gold-plated system. It's a phony gold standard, once again, okay, that everyone is pushing for. This would be a disaster. If we went back to this type of a gold standard, the gold standard would be buried. I mean, once that system would collapse, and people would again blame gold. Okay. So I'll stop here, and I'll take one question or two. Yes? Yes. Huh? Okay. No. Okay, that's a good question. So the question is, why competitive devaluation? Why would countries want to make their currencies cheaper? The reason is that, at least in the short run, when you make your currency cheaper, okay, in terms of foreign currency, your goods become cheaper, okay? Because it takes less foreign currency to buy the same amount of your currency. So they can buy more goods from you. And once they buy more goods from you, that increases the demand for goods, and therefore countries will, or firms will, put more workers back to work. So it was a way of trying to reduce the unemployment caused by the business cycle. Okay, but that doesn't, in the long run, that's not, that eventually your prices are going to rise so high that that effect is not going to continue. And secondly, it's not even going to take you till the long run, because foreign countries will retaliate as they did in the 1930s and are doing today. Yes. Yeah. No, because it takes a longer time for the price of goods to go up than it does for the price of a currency in terms of other currencies to go down. Because you have very, very shrewd speculators operating on the foreign exchange markets. Okay, last question. Well, the question is, when you have a foreign currency in your country, when it's being used and circulated, is it a type of gold standard? I wouldn't say it's a type of gold standard, but it's an alternative that, if it's less inflationary, allows you to conserve more of your wealth. So I think it is good when foreign currencies circulate in a domestic economy, and I would like that to happen in the U.S. today. Okay, thank you.